Hello, hello, and here we are. Where have you been? No, wait, where have I been? Well, I've been here. I just have been on an unannounced break. But okay, I'm back. I'm here. What have you been up to? You can find me on Twitter at PodPinky and let me know. What have I been up to? Let's see. I binged Stranger Things, and I'm totally caught up on that, and I'm just going, well, might be spoilers, right? But let me just say that final episode, you know, so not cool, but can't wait for a season 5. What else? I got all up into Final Fantasy 7, 8, 9, 10, 10, 2. Yes, PlayStation Plus has upgraded their memberships in a way where I got to download those all for free. Now, I've played them in the past, but nostalgia, we're talking in the old versions, like the old Final Fantasy VII with the little blocky hands. Oh my god, it's adorable. So I was playing those and cutting hair and doing the usual. I had a novel come out, Dark Wings, Urban Fantasy, Male-Male Romance by S. Royt, R-O-I-T. I would be honored if you would go check that out. It's doing okay, and people seem to really like it. And I think that's the quickie catch-up of what I have been doing. Speaking of Stranger Things, though, it made me kind of want to look into a couple of things. So one of those I'll talk about today. Did you know that the working title of Stranger Things was The Montauk Project, or just Montauk? I think it was just Montauk. And what is the Montauk Project, you might ask? Well, it's considered a conspiracy theory, and it alleges that a series of projects slash experiments by the U.S. government at Camp Hero, aka Montauk Air Force Station in Montauk, New York, took place. The purpose was to develop a means to utilize psychological warfare and even go so far as time travel. No, really. There was also something called MK Ultra that they were inspired by, but we'll get to that another time. So the story of Montauk originated with some books by someone named Preston Nicholas. And the stories also included some Bulgarian experiment, I guess. And Peter Moon is listed as a co-author from 1992 onwards. And these are written in first person. They are classified as sci-fi. I mean, they do claim to time travel, to even visit Jesus Christ. And they alter the outcome of the Civil War, so they claim. Okay. So stories of the Montauk Project go back to approximately the 80s. Preston Nicholas was born May 24th, 1946 on Long Island, and he claimed to recover repressed memories of this experiment. So this is where this all originates. He and someone named Al Bielek were supposedly abducted at different times and submitted for these experiments against their will. That sounds a little like 11 now, doesn't it? Now, Nicholas claims to have degrees in parapsychology, which is study of various psychic phenomena. He claims to have degrees in psychology and then electrical engineering, because of course, why not? Peter Moon, the book series co-author, as I mentioned, his name is actually Vincent Barbaric. So Peter Moon is a pen name. They do actually, I have to say, encourage speculation with a line quoted, "Whether you read this as science fiction or nonfiction, you are in for an amazing story." And that's in chapter one. So apparently there is even a 2015 documentary called The Montauk Chronicles. Have you seen it? I've never seen it. I don't think I've seen it. But you know what? I am just going to let thehumanexception.com take it from here, because they did a whole thing on it. the Montauk Project. Once a military base, much of Camp Hero today is a state park located on Montauk Point, New York. But between January 1971 and August 12, 1983, in an underground facility, it was home to a full bingo card of conspiracy theories, from aliens to mind control to psychic child soldiers and even time travel, which is supported by none other than the military. And how do we know this? Well, a bunch of white dudes in the 80s realized they had forgotten about a decade of their lives or more, but don't worry! Their memories have been since recovered. Now, if you want to know more about the Montauk Project, they say, be sure to check out the Montauk Project Proof and Disproof after, which we will. We will after we read this intro. So Montauk, New York, as they mentioned, is a town whose list of conspiracy theories and legends is longer than its phone book, and it spends most of the year sparsely populated. Big vacation homes line the beach, and they're all empty, you know, a lot of the time, waiting for the wealthy New Yorkers to return in the summer. The full-time residents of Montauk count at a little over 3,000, and their primary trades are fishing and tourism, which they get a lot of, both fish and tourists. Just outside of Montauk is what remains of Camp Hero, a strategic military foothold with roots all the way back to the Revolutionary War. In 1942, the U.S. Army commissioned the construction of Camp Hero, also known as the Montauk Air Force Station, all part of America's coastal defense strategy. If the Nazis ever made it over the pond, it was well disguised as a small fishing village. This camouflage, one of the many reasons it's viewed so suspiciously. But really, the best defense is a defense that the enemy doesn't know you have. By the mid-80s, the government realized they were probably pretty safe from the Nazis, and the bulk of the land was donated to the National Park Service, and the base itself was decommissioned. I'll share these pictures, as usual, on Instagram at pinky_podcast. There's a beautiful lighthouse, Montauk Point Lighthouse, and there's a little map here for, it looks like, the park and where you can hike and all kinds of things, maybe camp. So I'll share that. Looks pretty cool. Wouldn't mind visiting, I think, up on the water. Block Island Sound is what it's on, the Atlantic Ocean, and then a little lake called Oyster Pond. So yeah, it looks pretty cool. Through the 80s and 90s, not much happened there with the land until September 18, 2002, when it opened as Camp Hero State Park. Now, some parts of the camp remained closed off and guarded, especially areas near the old satellite installations. But for the most part, it's hard to imagine that anything horrific and terrible happened here, but according to a handful of people, it did. Dun, 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 the Montauk Project. So trying to read about this theory from second and third hand sources left my head, their head, the author of this, reeling. Every article seemed to tackle some different aspect of the theory, and none of them provided a clear timeline of events in any fashion. Stories about secret government experiments in the Montauk area have allegedly circulated since the 1980s, but wouldn't reach the public consciousness until a 1992 publication. So this person gave up and grabbed the 25th anniversary edition of the Montauk Project, Experiments in Time. And I think they're speaking of the novel. So Experiments in Time. And that is, again, the title, The Montauk Project, Experiments in Time, written by Preston Nichols and Peter Moon, a.k.a. Vincent, what was it? Vincent, oh, I lost my quickie little notes already. Hang on. I want to, Vincent Barbaric. Yes, Vincent Barbaric. The primary areas of interest for the project were these supposed military experiments. Already mentioned this time travel, teleportation, mind control, contact with extraterrestrial life, and staging faked Apollo moon landings. They're just covering everything. So in the book, Nichols claims that he recovered a slew of repressed memories about his role in the project. And after the book was published, more people apparently came forward claiming similar recovered memories. I think a lot of times, though, that's the power of suggestion. Or, you know, shall we say people with strange ideas about themselves? That's the polite way. The book became really popular, of course, among conspiracy theorists, and it spawned several sequels. And it has since inspired a plethora of books, movies, and TV shows. And if any of this sounds familiar, they mention here also, it was a source of inspiration for the Netflix show Stranger Things. So where is the line between fact and fiction here? Is there even a line? Because here is the opening of the book. Because the subject matter of this book is controversial, we would like to offer some guidelines. Some of the data you will read in this book can be considered as soft facts. Soft facts are not untrue, they are just not backed up by irrefutable documentation. A hard fact would be documentation or hard physical evidence that could stand up to scrutiny. By the nature of the subject matter and security considerations, hard facts about the Montauk Project have been very difficult to obtain. This work is being presented as nonfiction as it contains no falsehoods to the best knowledge of the authors. However, it can also be read as pure science fiction if that is more suitable to the reader. And that is a quote from Preston Nichols, the author. Another quote. Preston Nichols has always tried to avoid hard facts as stated above, not because they do not exist, but rather because, per his statement, he is afraid to prove the Montauk Project for fear of his life. While I believe his fears are passé due to the time that has passed since his employment in the defense industry, it does not behoove myself nor anyone else to overlook the trauma he experienced and how this might affect his decision-making. And that is a quote from Peter Moon. Vincent. Okay, so back to the article. This book is considered the heart and origins of the conspiracy theory. It's where it all comes from, and that's how it starts. Quote, I feel like I don't need to say this, but this is going to be a wild fucking ride. Hold on to your butts. So Nichols, AIL days, it's called AIL, 1971. Preston Nichols has started a new job at a company known as AIL, Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I don't know why I said it that way. It sounds cool. Laboratory. Nichols claims to be a down-to-earth man and electrical engineer with a specialty in electromagnetic phenomena and with little interest in the paranormal. Like, no interest. Sounds normal, right? But on the side, he's been given a grant to study telepathy. And the study was intended to prove the existence of it, but Nichols took it as an opportunity to disprove it, which apparently he failed to do. His research was pretty straightforward, collaborating with a handful of purported psychics, performing tests and recording their responses. I guess everyone needs a hobby. In 1974, Nichols discovers that every day at the same hour for 20 minutes, all the psychics he worked with would experience some sort of mind jamming, which prevented them from thinking effectively. Nichols suspected electrical interference, so he took some radio equipment and attempted to trace the signal. He tracked it back to a radar antenna located on a nearby military base known as our Camp Hero. He tried to investigate it, but security wouldn't let him on site. With no access to the broadcast point, Nichols was forced to forget about this strange phenomenon for approximately the next 10 years. 1984. Nichols gets word that Camp Hero has been abandoned, and he sees an opportunity with Brian, someone named Brian, one of his psychic subjects, so they sneak into what remains of the base. Debris and papers are scattered everywhere, as if the place had been abandoned in a hurry. They come across what looks like a homeless man who tells them he's been living there since the base had been abandoned the previous year. He goes on to say that there had been a big experiment that went haywire, which is why the base was abandoned. What was, which, far-fetched as it was sounding, the man went on to say that he had been a technician at the base and that Nichols had been his boss. Dun, dun, dun. He said that Nichols and many of the other scientists had fled the base when a beast had appeared on the base in the culminating event that would shut it down. He described a myriad of experiments and the studies the base had been involved in, from weather management to mind control. Do you think it was the mind flare, you guys? Or was it the Demigorgon? I don't know. That's me, by the way. I'm just, you know, you gotta work in the Stranger Things. Where was I? So 1984. Oh, I already read that part. They repeated themselves, not my fault. It was almost like Google Roulette. So this homeless guy, you know, he said that Nichols and many of the other scientists fled the base, you know, because of that beast, right? Nichols didn't believe any of this. A few weeks later, while Nichols was working on in his personal lab at the back of his house, a stranger barged in. He claimed that he knew Nichols and that he'd been this man's boss. He mentioned a lot of the same things the homeless man had, including that it had snowed in the middle of August and that hurricane winds, storms, hail, and lightning came out of nowhere. He also talked about the strange animal behavior, where wild animals were coming into town en masse, sometimes crashing through windows. I'm sure this would be easily researched, which we will get to. Nichols decided to talk to the chief of police about these strange events, who actually confirmed them, supposedly. And the chief of police even talked about a strange period of time where crimes were only committed in a two-hour window every day. And also during this time, teenagers were reported to get together suddenly in big groups. And then after this two-hour window, they would all go their separate ways. This is just wild. Yeah, they weren't kidding. So after this point, things got even stranger. Stranger things. Soon, people he would run into in town, Nichols, that is, and at the office, and even at some ham radio fests that I guess he was a big fan of, they all claimed to know him, even though he didn't remember seeing them before. And each of them would come with their own plethora of strange stories about events at Camp Hero. So to sum up that little part again, all of these people are claiming to know Nichols and that he was their boss, like he was in charge of a bunch of these experiments, but he doesn't remember it. That's the summary thus far. Now, November 1984, Nichols, again, is working in the lab at the back of his house, and the guy who showed up was Duncan Cameron. Duncan shows up with a piece of radio equipment, and he wanted Nichols to help him with it. And Nichols, being a very well-known, you know, radio nerd in the area, this was not unusual. So, but when they got to talking, Duncan reveals to Nichols that he's psychic. And so Nichols tells him about a study that he's been working on for the last decade. Now, remember, this was his own little separate thing, right? Nothing to do with Camp Hero. And Duncan wanted to get involved. He showed a surprising aptitude for the work. He was the perfect partner for Nichols in his research, almost too perfect. And I guess this made Nichols suspicious. So Nichols decided to take Duncan to Camp Hero. He told him he just wanted to see if he recognized the place. Remember, you know, because everybody's like, oh, you know, you used to be the boss there. Apparently, Duncan did remember it. And he was even able to tell Nichols what each of the buildings had been for, where to find the mess hall, bulletin board, and a lot of other details that only someone who had spent a lot of time there would know. So Duncan, with Nichols, was able to expand on the kind of research that had been done there. When they entered the transmitter building, it was called, Duncan entered into a trance and began to spew information. Nichols shook him out of it and brought him back to his own house in his own labs, where he did work with him to unblock his memories. And the more they unlocked, the more Duncan could tell him about research that had been done, and he told him about the Montauk Project. So then Duncan blurts out that he had been programmed to come to Nichols, befriend him, kill him, and destroy all his research. Duncan had no conscious recollection of this up until that moment, and he swore he would no longer help those that had programmed him, whoever they were. Nichols continues to work with this guy, and more is revealed, including that he's also been involved in the Philadelphia experiment. Because what fun is it, dear listeners, if you don't start putting all of the conspiracy theories together? And he says he was part of the crew with his brother Ed. And it wasn't just Duncan, though, that was remembering these things. Nichols, this is when he begins to remember things, including his involvement with the Montauk Project. I don't know. Neither Duncan or Nichols knew what to do with this information. So July 1986 now, let's skip forward a little bit. These two go on to do a panel at the U.S. Psychotronics Association, USPA, conference outside of Chicago. There they would talk about their recovered memories and the experiments of Camp Hero. This talk caused an uproar and word got around fast, just as they had planned, apparently. So with their story public, they thought this would give them some defense against those that wouldn't want them to dig into it. This is when they connected with Al Bielek. I think that is not quite the same thing I had written down somewhere, but no, that's right, Al Bielek. He heard their talk, and it triggered memories in him as well. So he joined, now we've got three of them, he joined the other two on their hunt for the truth. So according to this, there's like two timelines. 1989, for Nichols, he had normal memories from the period of 1973 to 1983, but recovering his memories told him that he had been working on the Montauk Project during that time. Eventually, he and Duncan realized that Nichols had been existing in two separate timelines. Variants, anyone? As Nichols puts it, as bizarre as it may sound, it was the only sensible explanation under the circumstances. Okay, dude, sure. So Nichols could remember years where he'd come home and been totally exhausted. But, you know, was this the toll the split realities took on him? I don't know. 1990, on one day, Nichols had been constructing a Delta T antenna on the roof of his laboratory. As he worked on the antenna, more and more of his memories seemed to recover until one day in early June, he remembered everything. All I could figure was that the Delta T antenna was storing up time flux waves as I was connecting it together, he said. I don't know, people. Do you? I have no idea what we're talking about. July 1990, Nichols was laid off, and not long after, all of his close connections were removed as well. After working at AIL for close to 20 years, he no longer had links to any friends in the company. Peter Moon would then meet Nichols shortly after this. That's Vincent, right? Nichols would eventually tell Moon about his recovered memories, and the two began talking about writing a book. So a little backtracking here before you get into the actual Montauk Project. We're going to mention that Philadelphia experiment, also something the Rainbow Project. So the Philadelphia experiment, briefly, is an alleged United States Navy experiment, aka Project Rainbow, done August 12, 1943. According to legend, the destroyer USS Eldridge was made invisible, Dematerialized, and teleported from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to Norfolk, Virginia, and then back again to the Philadelphia Naval Yard. The experiment allegedly had horrible side effects on the crew of the ship, and some of them went insane. Others developed mysterious illnesses. Others still were said to have been fused together with the ship. They were still alive, but their limbs were sealed to the metal. As you might imagine, the Navy decided that this technology was too dangerous, and they abandoned it, conveniently. A Dr. Von Neumann, Duncan Cameron, and his brother Ed were all involved in this experiment. So yes, this is apparently the same psychic named Duncan that worked on the Montauk Project with Nichols and his brother Ed. This claims that was Al Bielek in a previous life. Are you up with me so far? So, in the late 1940s, the U.S. government had begun weather control project codenamed Phoenix. The concept and technology came from Wilhelm Reich, an Austrian scientist. Reich is the man responsible for the discovery of orgone energy, also known as orgasmic or life energy. Orgone itself wasn't controversial, but when he started claiming it could cure cancer, it raised some eyebrows. But Project Phoenix wasn't interested in orgon. It was interested in DOR, aka deadly orgone radiation. Reich had claimed that DOR was created during violent storms, and he believed if this energy could be harnessed, the weather could be controlled. Reich gave his research to Project Phoenix, and that's the only way he was involved, I guess. That was that. That was the end of his involvement. The project merged his technology with government technology, and the result was what we know today as radio sonde to monitor weather. I don't know what that is, do you? But I guess it's cool. The unspoken terrifying implication is that the government knows how to prevent catastrophic weather events, but also how to create them. Something apparently Russia has already been doing for some time. Oh, just... I love how conspiracy theories just go one into another, don't you? So in 1948, the Phoenix Project, recruited Dr. John von Neumann and some of his team from the Philadelphia Experiment because they saw an opportunity to blend the technology of both projects. And the goal was to figure out what had gone wrong with the, quote, human factor. In the 1950s, Brookhaven Labs on Long Island became the project headquarters, and the doctor was put in charge. Dr. Von Neumann. The team spent 10 years trying to figure out why humans had trouble with electromagnetic fields that shifted them through different times and places. Now, I do know from paranormal research, and they're always talking about how electromagnetic fields can affect us. They can, if you are living in an area or in a house with like a lot of wiring, bad wiring, a lot of electricity create these fields around you, it can give you headaches, make you feel sick, and cause paranoia. You should, you know, if you have any of that in your house, by the way, check into your electricity. Have an electrician come out. No joke. So, but back to this. They discovered, in this conspiracy stuff, that all humans are born with a time reference point. At conception, they say, a soul is attached to a timeline and we all start from that point. This point is the basic orientation point you have to the universe and how it operates. What happened with the Philadelphia experiment? Was that this reference point was thrown off kilter. That's what they decided. 1967, the Phoenix Project is completed, and the report was turned into Congress. The project identified the potential the technology had to manipulate and change what and how the human mind thinks. Congress said, no. They were concerned that if the wrong people got a hold of this technology, it could be used against them. You think? 1969, Congress orders this project to be disbanded. You with me so far? I'm so confused. Project Phoenix 2, or the Montauk Project. Brookhaven saw the potential of their work and thought Congress was denying a huge opportunity, so they reached out to the military. They proposed a world where they could just flip a switch to make their enemies surrender. And so the military was like, heck yeah! Financing would be required to build a new lab to perform proper experiments in seclusion. They would also need some equipment and personnel from the military. An important piece of equipment was SAGE radar. The military was apparently more than happy to supply this, and they gifted it to the shuttered Camp Hero with its intact SAGE radar station. So this is how, okay, I... I'm sorry, this is written, I love all of the research they've done, but there's something awkward about how this is written. So, the whole article, but props to them. I need to find the author. That reminds me, I have to shout out the actual author. So Camp Hero was the gift. Yes. And this is how the Phoenix 2 project began, which colloquially, there's a tough word for me, was known as the Montauk Project later by Nichols and Company, you know, due to the location, obviously. So a project like that, you couldn't just run it out of your garage, right? It was a multi-billion dollar venture that would need equipment, staff, materials, and, you know, the usual amenities. And it had to be top secret because they were defying Congress, right? So no one could know what they were up to. You know, just, they're just designing mind control, no big deal. So the military couldn't finance it because it would draw too much attention. And the financing itself is shrouded in mystery, but appears to have been totally private. I do not have documented evidence myself of the financing, but have been told by my Montauk acquaintances that the original money came courtesy of the Nazis. And that's a quote from the book, you know, Nichols. So there is a whole story about Nazi gold that is missing. But as the author says here, we ain't got time for that. What you should know is that the Nazi gold did eventually run out. But they had backup funding from Freemasons and the mob. So there you go. 1970-71, preparing the facility. It was Camp Hero was converted to a proper testing facility, staff hired, equipment acquired, and set up. It took about a year before it got going. So we officially have the start date, I guess, late 1971. This staff was a mix of military personnel, government employees, and employees that just came from various different corporations. And apparently Nichols was one of those. And he joined the project in 1973. Which is around the same time Duncan joined up. What did this project do? The original intention seemed to be mind control and stealth technology for the military to use. The experiments at Camp Hero kind of stumbled across a myriad of applications. They would have dozens of initiatives going by the time they were shut down. And there were a lot of them that kind of crisscrossed with each other, which makes it hard to distinctly define where one project ends and another begins. You have the microwave oven experiments. And the basis of the project was the discovery that when the stealth radar was on, it seemed to affect the overall mood of anyone in range. By changing the frequency and pulse duration of the radar, they could manipulate the emotions of those within its range. And Nichols called it the microwave oven experiments. I wonder if that's where some of the stuff came from, of people being afraid of microwave ovens. You remember how, oh, don't have it in your house. Don't stand too close. It's going to affect you. People still think that. I don't know. 72-73... The military, apparently desperate to see where this technology would go, offered their own people as unknowing guinea pigs. So different army units were sent to Montauk, supposedly for a R&R. And Montauk is a beautiful area. The outer base had a nice gym, a bowling alley, and they had great food and accommodations. Yeah, they just didn't let them know about the mind control experiments. So after some success of local tests, they expanded their range to include the townspeople in Long Island, New Jersey, upstate New York, and Connecticut to see how far it would go. So I guess they were doing this, spreading this around to a bunch of other people, unbeknownst to them. I suppose that goes back to the two-hour time windows, right? Of only crime then, and teenagers only hang out for 2 hours a day. So they had their mind control going, right? Now they needed some nuance and precision. And the nightmarish results of the Philadelphia Project were always in the forefront of their minds. How do you solve this human factor? With a human, of course. So they built a chair that was designed to pick up the brain waves of a psychic sitting in the chair, which combining the psychic's will with the power of the radar technology. This setup became the linchpin of the entire project, which would then be known as Montauk Chair. This is where the three big proponents show up. Nichols, hired to help with radio frequencies and transmitter. Duncan Cameron, the psychic, if you remember, who would sit in the chair. And then Al Bielek, with his history in the Philadelphia experiment, had the personal experience they, you know, required to guide the team. Getting everything up and running, there was a lot of trial and error. They had a lot of issues with interference and calibration over the next 2 years, and that was mostly what they dealt with during that time. In 1975, they were still not having luck overcoming the interference issues, so they go back to their original plans to figure out where they went wrong. The plans were made by the Syrians, by the way, and who are those people, you might ask, just like I did? Well, they're just an alien race. They're an alien race from the Sirius star system. We've got everything in this one, folks. Everything. Everything but the kitchen sink, or maybe even the kitchen sink. So they consult these original alien plans, and they found that the coils that were connected to the crystals... Let me say that again. Coils connected to crystals instead of ordinary electronics. Oh my goodness, how could we not know this? So they put out a contract to devise a new chair, to build a new chair. I'm actually beginning to think that I'm not sure if English is their first language here, because I feel like there's a whole lot of shit left out, do you? But I'm going to give it to you as is, because that's just how crazy this is anyway. Now they mention RCA. You might be thinking of that old television your parents had in the basement, right? It hummed when you turned it on. Do you remember some old ones like that? Why would RCA be hired to make a futuristic chair of alien design? Well, that's thanks to Nikola Tesla, apparently. Quote, to get the Montauk chair operating without interference, they had to replicate what the crystal receivers did with the Sirian technology. In the 1930s, Nikola Tesla had designed receivers for RCA under the name N-Turbo, T-E-R-B-O. These coil receivers were perfect for the Montauk chair. So they supposedly created sort of a force field around the chair, which then dealt with any interference they were getting. They don't go on to say what this interference is. I have a feeling I would have to read this silly book. So by late 1977, everything now is working, apparently. And projecting the image of someone's thoughts is old news, because they had Duncan concentrating on solid objects. He could cause a copy of these objects to form out of the ether. I'm trying to translate this here. Like, you could see it. The duplicate didn't always end up when or where it was intended. Like, he was moving these objects, I guess. It might show up in a mess hall, you know, 4 hours later. So I guess he's moving things with his mind or teleporting it. But they were on to something, apparently. Apparently, they were so on to something. In one case, Duncan imagined a whole building onto the base grounds. And I'm unclear as to whether other people saw this. Apparently so. So he projected either the image or I think it's an image of a building. I'm so confused, are you? We might consider this a little bit of Google Roulette episode. So the Montauk Chair Phase 2. They continued to expand the scope of their project. They're pushing Duncan further and further. So far, he doesn't sound like he has any 11, you know, like, oh, I can with the nose bleeding, but apparently he projects these images. Duncan is channeling now his powers into different applications. The quickie version, the seeing eye. This is Duncan using a personal effect where he could see through another person's eyes and feel or hear all the things that person could. And that's using the chair. thought implantation. He could apparently implant specific thoughts into other people's minds. Here we get into the 11 stuff, right? He could reportedly move or destroy objects all the way out in town for where he was. And he could drive animals into town, if you remember that being mentioned before, or start a crime wave. So that's like mind control. Nichols apparently stated that it's important to note that Duncan was in an altered state of consciousness whenever he would perform these experiments. By 1978, the mind control techniques were developed and recorded. Appropriate tapes were made and distributed to different agencies so that it could be worked into something practical. In 1979, it was noticed that every once in a while, Duncan's thoughts would just stop. And at first they thought it was a malfunction, but then later determined that his thoughts had entered into a different time stream. And this is when they realized they could possibly use it for time travel. Now, it was very exciting, right? So the staff at the project were sent to mandatory conferences with a focus on time and how time functions. They didn't want to create any time paradoxes. So one of the key things they had to learn about was something called zero time. Zero time is the great nothing that exists outside of universes, the empty, timeless, and nothingness. All human souls have a tether to their time reference point. All universes are connected to a zero point, and all zero points coincide but never move. Yeah, sure, I understand that, do you? This is a point in space-time that no matter what is a complete constant. So think of a merry-go-round, multiple universes being the horses, and the center column is the zero point. A zero time reference would be vital to unlocking time travel. And thankfully, good old Tesla had created a zero time reference generator, that is, in the 20s. So it consisted of an assortment of spinning widgets and rotating wheels. And colloquially, we referred to it as a whirligig. And I think that's another quote from Nichols. Now, this is alleged zero time generator, okay? So this device would supposedly help provide coordinates that could be used as your tether, right? You don't want people floating around willy-nilly through time, la la la, you know, oh my God, where am I? Loki variants, ah! We have the new Disney Plus show right here, folks. So the process is said to go as follows. Duncan would sit in the Montauk chair. He would clear his mind, focus on a window of time from the current date to the desired date. This would open a portal nearby that anyone could walk through. And like, let's say he was imagining 1990. So that would lead them to 1990. And this door would remain open for as long as Duncan maintained his concentration. So don't nobody distract him or you'll get stuck, right? Quote, I've been told by those who entered the tunnel that it looked like a spiral similar to science fiction style renditions of a vortex. When outside the tunnel, it looked like you were looking through space, from one circular opening through space to a circular but little bit smaller window at the other end. Sounds like a telescope or looking through a tube, maybe, perspective. I was considered too valuable to the technical operation, was not allowed to travel through the portal. And I think that's a quote from Nichols. So yeah, how convenient. You don't get to try it. From 1980 to 1981, they were then trying to be, you know, they were focusing on being consistent and being much more precise. And their three primary anchor points were created based on Earth's biorhythms. It says here, don't ask. Okay, I won't. So those points were 1943, 1963, and 1983. I don't know. 2020. Once the process was hammered out and that they could repeat it, you know, with no problems, Camp Hura was vacated until only key personnel remained. And among those, of course, were Bielek, Duncan, and Nichols. The new objective was to explore time. They would scout the past and the future and take note of the circumstances. Through the vortex, they could sample the air, the terrain, and everything without even entering the portal. For the most part, this seemed safe. The only issue was if the base lost power while someone was in the tunnel. They would be forever lost in time and space. See, that's what I was saying before, like, oh my God, right? Quote, it was routine to create a tunnel, grab somebody off the street, and send them down. Most of the time, these people were winos or derelicts whose absence wouldn't create a furor. That's just awful. Shame on you. If they returned, they would make a full report on what they had encountered. You notice they say if. Most of the winos used for the experiments were sobered up for a week before entering a portal. But many didn't make it back. We don't know how many people are still floating around in time, whenever, wherever, and however. Well, ain't that just nice? I'm just going to send you out to float around in time without a bottle of wine. You know, if this was even true, assholes. As they became more advanced in their experiments, they figured out that TV and radio signals would also travel through portals. So they began to wire up their subjects so that they could still get data, even if they never returned and were lost forever. They were escorted through the portals, some more willingly than others. So now it's being called the Montauk Boys Project. Quote, in addition to the derelicts, the researchers also used kids for some reason. I'm not sure what exactly the purpose was, but there was one kid at Montauk who would go out and get other kids and bring them to the project. He was like a tractor beam. He lived in Montauk and would circulate around very effectively. Some kids returned home, some didn't. The kids chosen were between 10 and 16, or maybe 18 at the oldest and 9 at the youngest. Most were just about to reach puberty or had just finished it. They were usually blonde, blue-eyed, tall, and light skin. They fit the Aryan stereotype. To my knowledge, there were no girls in this group. A later investigation showed that Montauk had a neo-Nazi connection and that the Nazis were still on the Aryan kick. We don't know where the kids went, what they were educated in or programmed for. Whether they came back or not is still a mystery. What information is available is that they sent every raw recruit into the future to 6037 AD, always to the same point, to what appeared to be a dead city in ruins. Everything was stationary, not unlike a dream state. There were no signs of life. In the center of the city was a square with a gold horse on a pedestal. There were inscriptions on that pedestal, and recruits were sent there to read what they said. Each recruit would interpret and report. We still don't know what the researchers were after. They could have been trying to find the same answer from different people. I don't know. Duncan suggested there was technology in the pedestal and that they were trying to get somebody to sense or feel what the technology was. Someone else involved in the project has said that the horse was there to test the powers of observation of the recruits and that it also served as a point of reference. The recruits were always asked if they saw anybody in the city. We know a lot of people were shoved somewhere into the future, maybe 200 or 300 years ahead. Estimates range from 3,000 to 10,000 people that were eventually abandoned. We have no idea for what purpose. End quote. That's a whole lot of people, y'all. Nichols and much of the staff were kept out of the loop on the intentions of the project. He does know that they did a lot with World War I and World War II. And they mean like going through time, going back in time, you guys. They monitored and taking pictures during that time. They also discovered that they could record Duncan's brainwaves when establishing a portal to a specific time and place onto tapes. And the tapes could then be used to reopen the portals without Duncan having to hang around. It gets weirder, guys. 1981-82, Mars. The technology was used to gain access into the underground areas in the Big Pyramid on the planet Mars, and it's called Cydonia. In 1972, the Viking 1 and 2 satellites took a bunch of pictures of Mars, Among these images were the famous face. You know, you've heard of the face of Mars, right? And the pyramid of Mars. It's a common conspiracy theory that these indicate the remains of a Martian civilization, and it is commonly known as Cydonia. The Time Scouts, as we shall call them, had scoured Mars for living inhabitants and were forced to go back 125,000 years before they could find any. Nichols doesn't know what they found out, and Duncan can no longer recall these details. Not all of them, anyway. One thing Duncan does recall is that they found technology they called the Solar System Defense. This is some sort of technology that seems to protect our solar system from external forces. The Montauk team disabled the system and retroactively disabled it from 1943 on. So we were protected, and now we're just shit out of luck for some reason. It is apparently commonly considered among UFOologists that 1943 is the beginning of the massive UFO phenomena that we now have. Quote, "There's not much more I can say about Mars at this point except that the movie Total Recall is fancifully based upon some of the events that occurred with the Montauk Project. The way they used the chair in the movie is strikingly similar." Interesting. And now, of course, it wouldn't be anything without an end of days discussion. These missions kept running until August 5th, 1983. And on August 5th, 1983, they were given the direction to run the transmitter nonstop. They did as they were told, but nothing out of the ordinary occurred until the 12th. Equipment dropped out of sync with its target and instead locked onto something else. The USS Eldridge. Exactly 40 years prior, at the time of the Philadelphia experiment. Nichols is uncertain if this had been the intention all along or if it was an accident. Through the portal, they could see the ship and in 1943, Duncan and his brother Ed. The researchers ensured that 1983 Duncan didn't see himself to avoid a time paradox. Quote, "Natural laws were being violated, and it seemed everyone involved felt uncomfortable. Three colleagues and myself had privately been voicing misgivings about the project over a period of months. We had talked about the pitfalls of dealing with time and how this might affect the karma of the planet. We hoped the project would truncate itself. Consequently, our little cabal created a contingency program that only Duncan could activate, and it was designed to crash the entire project. So someone from the group approached Duncan while he was still in the chair, and they whispered, 'The time is now.' And it was from that moment that all hell broke loose. Duncan's thoughts shifted, and no one could have anticipated what happened next. Elsewhere on the base, Duncan had manifested a monster from his subconscious." There's an alleged picture of it here, too, although it seems to be broken on the page. I'll see if I can find it, because I'm like, okay, what does it look like? Does it look like a demigorgon? And they called him Junior. Quote, "It was big, hairy, hungry, and nasty." Okay, it doesn't sound like a demigorgon. "It would eat anything it could find." That does. "And it smashed everything in sight. Several different people saw it, but almost everyone described a different beast. It was either 9 feet tall or 30 feet tall, depending on who saw it. I personally believe it was about 9 or 10 feet in height. Fright does strange things to people, and no one was sure what the exact physical constitution of this monster was. No one was in any frame of mind to calmly and collectively analyze its exact nature." So it could have been a demigorgon, yo. Nicholas's supervisor ordered the generators to be switched off, hoping to stop this phenomena, but it did nothing. So now they've tackled this problem in two ways. Somebody needed to go through the portal to Eldridge to turn off the transmitters there in the time frame of 1943, and somebody needed to stop the transmitters in present day then, Montauk. Nicholas was the one that was responsible for the ones in Montauk. When the off switch, pulling the plug, and disconnecting power at the base failed, he took an acetylene torch to the cables, and then they hacked at the transmitter and the control panel until finally the transmitter groaned and stopped. This really would make a wild-ass movie, wouldn't it? quote, "All the lights went off. We'd done it." It was at this point that the beast stopped moving and faded back into the ether. The portal closed, and that was the end of that episode. Today, you can still see the torch marks where I'd cut things apart. Now, those people who went into 1943 to shut down the transmitter rescued as many people as they could from the USS Eldridge. And after that, the power was restored to the base, but the base was then emptied as most personnel were rounded up, debriefed, and brainwashed accordingly. May, June 1984. A squad of Black Berets descended on the abandoned base. Reportedly, they were ordered to shoot anything that moved. They were followed by a second crew to remove all the secret equipment, which was considered too sensitive to leave behind. Quote, "The next step was to prepare the underground to be sealed. Certain incriminating evidence was removed at this point. I've heard that a room with hundreds of skeletons was cleared out during this time." Evolution, he says. 6 months later, a caravan of cement mixers were spotted at the base. They filled the vast underground areas of Camp Hero with cement, elevator shafts, stairwells, vents, anything that could lead to the redacted underground operations. Nichols says you can visit the base today, but it's illegal to cross the fence to the inside of the base and that there are other dangers to consider. In the late 80s, two people who Nichols knows were a part of the Montauk Project, tried to visit the site. They claimed they were abducted and don't remember what happened to them. Quote, "Who was really behind the Montauk Project? There are countless intrigues and scenarios one can envision. Religionists can bring in God and the devil. UFO aficionados can offer a grand scheme of aliens vying for our solar system. Left-wingers will offer explanations concerning the CIA and secret government. I believe that all of the above can shed light on what actually happened at Montauk. It is also my hope that this book will bring more people out of the woodwork." And the fallout. Since the publication of the book, dozens if not hundreds have come forward claiming knowledge about the Montauk Project, some claiming to have been part of the team, others being test subjects or victims. Nicholas, Bielek, and Cameron went on to tell their story wherever they could be heard. They hosted panels at conventions across the country and have been interviewed for television and radio programs. Bielek even once claimed to have given interviews to over 50 radio television shows and over 50 conventions. When they weren't doing this, they were still busy digging into this Montauk Project. Nichols and Cameron in particular would return to the base several times because they both lived nearby, and occasionally Bielek would fly out from Arizona, I guess where he lives, to come on these adventures. They would end up making two videos, The Truth About the Philadelphia Experiment and The Montauk Tour. Apparently, you could, at the time of this, get VHS copies through the mail. It looks like there's a little clip of it. Maybe I'll be able to share it, or I'll just share this webpage. January 1993 to 53 p.m. is the tag on this video. VHS, this is a VHS rip of the Montauk tour, it says. We'll see if I can share it. In 1993, Peter Moon began the Montauk Pulse, which is a quarterly newsletter people could subscribe to keep up with all the latest discoveries. Nichols also started hosting Montauk Nights, where once a month he and others would get together and talk about all things Montauk. Nichols went on to write three more books with Moon about Montauk. Now, around the time of publication, Stuart Swerdlow would come forward, claiming to be one of the Montauk boys. Swerdlow became part of the core crew and even published a book in 1998 detailing his experience, and it's called Montauk, The Alien Connection. So these four men, Bielek, Cameron, Nichols, and Swerdlow, are considered the source of the truth of this, but with a little searching, it's easy to find dozens of other accounts online. Whole websites are dedicated to these individual tales and investigations. Each rendition plugs in their own flavor and attaches a new handful of conspiracy theories to the legends. That's so common, right? Even if something starts with a kernel of truth, always other people start picking it up and they start adding and adding, and it snowballs until it includes everything, including the kitchen sink. Right. So So the thing about the Montauk Project is it's been about 30 years since the book was published. And there are still people every day coming forward saying that they have recovered memories. And it makes the mythos a living, breathing thing, which is always changing. And so as this author here says, you can understand my confusion when I started looking into this. There's a further link, the Montauk Project Proof and Disproof, which we will get to, I think. I think this is very interesting. So let's go to that now, shall we? And, you know, now that I think of it, I really don't see a name for this author. By the way, I was going to pause and shout out the person who actually wrote this. It just says, researched and presented by Kayla. But I don't know if that is for a different thing on here. So we'll just, I think we'll just shout out Kayla. There are two aspects to consider with this story. The people telling the stories and the stories themselves. So let's talk about the people. Al Bielek. In the book, Nichols said that he met Bielek after his 1986 talk, when Bielek claimed that he too had memories of the Montauk Project. But that's not actually the case, apparently. Nichols and Bielek were friends before the talk. There are even pictures of Bielek in the slideshow of the base that Nichols shows in that very talk. And even then he says they went to the base before 1985. Bielek's biggest claim to fame is his involvement in the Philadelphia experiment. In 1988, he saw the movie based on the story, and he said that's what triggered his memories and that it made him realize he had been involved. But there's a catch to this. The Philadelphia experiment happened in 1943, and Al was born in 1927. This would have made him 16 when the experiment happened. But Bielek has an explanation. See, it wasn't Bielek's first life. Before he was Al, he was Ed Cameron. Does that sound familiar? Duncan's brother, right? Who was born in 1916? The story is that he and his brother, who was born in 1917, Duncan again, became engineers that came into the employment of the Navy, and that's how they wound up in the Philadelphia experiment. Bielek claims that he and Duncan leapt from the USS Eldridge when the experiment began to go awry, and instead of landing in water, they landed in Montauk in 1983. So they time jumped. There's a lot of variances in the story. Sometimes in the leap from the ship, it allows them to traipse around in time doing who knows what. But here they're going to focus on the most common version of the story, that they show up in Montauk, August 12th, 1983, when everything broke loose. Remember when all hell broke loose and the monster and everything. So they're told that they need to go back through the portal to the Eldridge and shut down the transmitter no matter what. The brothers run back. They hack at the transmitter with an axe. Before the portal closed, though, Duncan jumped back through and returned to 1983, but he left his brother in 1943. Bielek carried on his life as Edward Cameron until 1947, when the Montauk Project called from 1983, needing his help with something. I'm confused, because if you had more than one life, how could you be living it? That's parallel. I don't know. Quote, they decided they didn't want me around anymore for whatever reasons, and they did a number on me. Total brainwashing. Established a new personality, shipped me back into the past, and I became Alfred Bielek. Okay, that explains it. With a new set of parents and a false birth certificate and a complete cover-up story which hung together and memories which may or may not be quite true, but nevertheless, still there. Well indoctrinated. I had not the foggiest notion that I had ever been involved in the Philadelphia experiment, much less the Phoenix Project, until sometime in 86. And that is a quote from Al. But here's the thing. People have found crew manifests of the Eldridge, and there was not a Cameron on board that ship. Not one, not two, or even three, as in some versions of the story. Bielek had a website made at one point where he had his entire story written out, including a timeline of his lives and pictures of him as Ed Cameron. Later, someone named Marshall Barnes proved that the alleged picture of Ed Cameron was stolen from a Princeton yearbook. Now we move to Duncan. Little is known about him, you know, other than what I've told you so far. He's the quietest of the four core Montaukians. The history we know about Cameron can be gotten just from the story. According to Bielik, he and Duncan were actually brothers, you know, as kind of touched upon. In Duncan's first life, he was born in 1917 and joined his brother on the Philadelphia Project, ultimately jumping to that point in 1983. Bielik says that when Duncan jumped back to 1983, he lost his time lock, which made him age rapidly at a rate of a year per hour, so that he died in just a few days. But the Montauk Project decided that Duncan was too valuable to just die, and they needed a backup body. This just, every time I think this can't get weirder. So the project group contacted Duncan Sr. in 1947, and they tell him about the situation. They tell him he needs to have a new son, because you can just totally pick the gender of your child. And apparently he thought that was a good idea, because he did. He was married to a different woman than Duncan's original mother, but apparently she was cool with her husband hooking up with his ex to have babies, because the future told him to. First they had a girl, which just wouldn't do, so he was sent back to the bedroom to try again. I'm sorry, but come on, that's funny. So a new Duncan is born in 1951, but due to time travel restrictions, they weren't able to implant his soul until August 12th, 1963. So this new Duncan had no memory of having a brother or the Philadelphia experiment, and this is the Duncan that grew up to join the Montauk Project in the early 70s as a psychic consultant. Have we got that? I'm going to have to make the red strings and the crime scene diagrams. So this Duncan begins to recover his memories of the Montauk Project at the end of 84, but never fully recovers the memories of his previous life. But according to Nichols, though Duncan might not remember what happened with the Montauk Project, Duncan's body did. Quote, upon visiting a doctor in 1988, Duncan's doctor commented upon the unusual scar tissue in his lungs. Previous research in or about 1986 indicated the Duncan was actually brain dead. Okay. You can't be brain dead and be walking around. Alrighty. Needless to say, Duncan's relationship with all of this is a bit tenuous. According to John Quinn, someone named John Quinn, in the fall of 1997, Duncan began to kind of pull back from all of this. Quote, Cameron is now known to be primarily and observably influenced by a woman who became very close to him in late 1997 and who would appear to be a monarch-type programmed agent herself. Since his association with this individual, Cameron has retracted charges related to massive, horrendous, abusive mind control operations, which involved thousands of young people during the Phoenix Montauk Project, and now contending the project was only involved with time travel and interdimensional technologies. Nicholas and Moon have both indicated that they feel Duncan has been put under some kind of control at the direction of his recent companion and her associates. That didn't stick. They state here they don't know what became of the relationship, but it wasn't long before Duncan was back on board with the whole conspiracy theory. In the last years of his life, Duncan offered online services. Personal energy clearing, $275. Intensive personal energy field clearing, $600. Couples therapy, $350 an hour by phone or in person, and he helped couples understand and broaden their interpersonal boundaries using playful, joyful, and non-threatening methods. Multiple sessions recommended. Dreamwalking services, $400. Peaceful crossing, I assume that's death, $300. Home clearing. Homes under 818, pardon, let me try again. Homes under 1850 square feet is $435. Homes up to 3,670 square feet, $680. Homes up to 8,680 square feet, $930. And he even did something called Safe Flight for $275. He was also doing conventions up until 2017. Now we get to Preston B. Nichols. You've been waiting. Born in Long Island, New York, 1946, he, alongside Al Bielek, are the proponents of the Montauk Project. Quote, Preston soon explained to me that he actually did secure an engineering diploma from the University of Tampa, but it was given on the basis of a series of challenge exams where you established that you had the equivalent knowledge thereof. Preston had gone to school previously at Brooklyn Polytech, where he quit after being disgusted with his professor for stealing his work. Preston was and is a genius and always has been. Far ahead of his peers when it comes to technical matters, he said that he never let human resources know about his engineering diploma, as it was more advantageous for him to work as a tech due to the fact that he would receive generous overtime pay. And that is a quote from Peter Moon. So it does appear that it's confirmed that Nichols worked for AIL, and there was a skeptic about all of this named Marshall Barnes, who had called their HR department and they confirmed it. But Montauk is not Nichols' only outlandish claim. He has also claimed that he was once volunteered onto an Air Force contract to study foreign aircraft, which turned out to be a UFO. He also has another favorite story wherein Mark Hamill, actually directed the 1984 film The Philadelphia Experiment, and that he grew up with Hamill, who actually grew up in California, by the way, and not Long Island. Well, I wasn't expecting that. Are we talking Luke Skywalker? Wow. Okay. I'm pretty sure Mark Hamill could, you know, come right out right now and say, yeah, no, I didn't do that. Nichols also frequently claims would frequently claim that his life was at risk or someone was trying to shut him up. Quote, Mr. Nichols has survived all kinds of slings and arrows. Unfortunately, not all of them metaphorical by any means. In early September 1995 and again in May 1996, attempts were made against his life. The former by means of a stage-contrived auto accident, which left Nichols seriously injured, he's since completely recovered, and the latter by means of a poison nerve gas attack carried out by the driver of a car who cut Nichols off as he was driving, which forced him to stop, at which point the gas was released. That's a quote by Peter Moon in the book. Between 1981 and 1999, Nichols hosted many panels at the USPA conferences, most to do with fringe science related to radio technology. Okay. Now we'll get to this Peter Moon guy. They say here they didn't know a lot about Moon before Montauk became a thing. I know Moon is a pseudonym, his real name being Vince Barbaric, and he had been in the Sea Org part of Scientology up until 1983, and he even claimed to have worked closely with LRH aboard the mystery ship Apollo. That's Ron Hubbard, by the way, the father of Scientology, who was, yeah, that guy. Oh, I better not say too much. They'll come after me. Moon portrays Hubbard as a white knight, one of the good guys, engaged in psychic warfare against malevolent mind controllers and reality manipulators. Yeah. Moon believes Hubbard to have been, on the whole, dedicated to the personal spiritual emancipation of human beings from programming of virtually any kind. FYI, Hubbard had written a ton of sci-fi books, and the Battlefield Earth is basically Scientology. It's his. He owns Skybooks, a publishing company he started in 1990 that he uses to publish Montauk-related titles. So it seems that Moon will be happy to ride the coattail of Montauk for the rest of his life. In 1993, Moon began the Montauk Pulse. We mentioned that, the newsletter. They say here they found an issue for 2003, 24 pages long, and only about 4 of them are original content. The rest is pretty much a catalog for anything remotely related that can be purchased from Skybooks. And then there's that Stuart Swerdlow, who also has a pseudonym, Stan Campbell. So the men, I'm quoting them, by the way, again, the men I have spoken about thus far are characters unto their own, but Stuart Swerdlow is something else entirely. Swerdlow loves to make every aspect about his life magical, from his birth, his mother was told she would never conceive, apparently, to his own DNA, because he claims to have multiple instances of alien DNA. He was also born on Long Island in the late 1950s. While in high school, Stuart was picked up at night and brought to Montauk, he claims. And he claims that only 1% of Montauk boys survived. But Swerdlow wasn't just a victim. He actually became a programmer of Montauk boys because of his special powers. Could that be Zero? Anyone? Anyone? Come on, Stranger Things, right? Going all the way back to Stranger Things. You know. Do you think that could be the inspiration for Zero? Special powers? Programmer? So Nichols and Swerdlow have been connected since at least 1991, when Nichols was allegedly helping him recover memories of his childhood abductions. In their investigation, they found that Swerdlow was abducted by 16 alien species. So apparently they just thought he was special too. Swerdlow has a lot to say about his experience at Montauk, but here we'll just mention two stories. He remembers that one of the bad guys on the base was named Hans von Gruber. Yes, that is the same name as the villain in Die Hard. Hans von Gruber. He also once had a mission to travel back in time to meet Jesus. Quote, his mission, as he remembers it, is to go find Jesus and do two things. First, he's supposed to remove a sample of blood, and then he's supposed to kill him. He finds Christ, and Christ even volunteers to give him the blood sample. Operating on his orders from Montauk, Swerdlow then reports on emptying a revolver into Christ. Which, well, that's not how the story goes. But unlike other proponents, Swerdlow isn't just some guy with an unremarkable life telling stories. In 1992, he was under investigation for bank fraud in regard to a large embezzlement from his employer. Swerdlow says he has no memory of committing this fraud and that he believed that the government had brainwashed him to siphon off the funds. Convenient. Swerdlow eventually did plead guilty, but later he said he was coerced. He was sentenced to 33 months in federal prison. He has done a very good job at scrubbing any articles about his arrest from the internet. He has been known to descend upon forums where he is being discussed in a negative tone and threatens legal action to those talking and even to the websites. It's not that he denies his time in prison. It's all part of his own narrative of the government's persistent efforts to shut him up. So here's a quote, apparently from Swerdlow's own website, about himself. This is how he talks about himself. Stuart, a linguist who speaks 10 languages, is an expert in deprogramming and determining which Illuminati programs are embedded in the mind patterns of any individual. His mission is to help others heal themselves in a positive way, thus avoiding the negativity he experienced. Also, Swerdlow likes to call himself Dr. Reverend Stuart A. Swerdlow. So on culteducation.com in 2008, a thread began discussing Swerdlow and his company Expansions. Expansions offers dozens of books on spiritual healing, aliens, and much more, written by Swerdlow and his wife Janet. The program also claims to be able to help people overcome trauma, to deprogram people, and to help scan your body for microchips. Did you get the vaccination? With techniques all designed by Swerdlow. And a common catchphrase of his is, you have probably been programmed. Otherwise, you wouldn't have found me. So, for such a wholesome web mission, they charge a lot, apparently, to do this. Like, a lot. And they love to scare people into silence with threats of legal action. So a lot of the stories have similar undercurrents. how the Swerdlows seem only interested in money and fame. And allegedly, the Swerdlows live in a million-dollar home. This is as of 2008, though. It's old information about them. On a large piece of land that they are constantly luring people to, making some sort of commune. They target wealthy people, women particularly. They put a lot of effort into isolating their victims. They convince them their partners, family, friends, and jobs are not their true path, and that they should abandon all that. There are a lot of stories, but there's one posted in 2011 that they think here gives the best insight onto them. There's someone named Jacaranda_tree tells the story of how they got involved with expansions in 2009. They had been a fan of the books and the website, so in March 2009, they reached out to Swerdlow because they had some questions. They received no answers, and they were instead suggested to book a consultation for the low price of $325 for 2 hours. Now, these are going to be directly from this user, Jacaranda, Jacaranda_tree, September 20th, 2011. What I was told during the first consultation was highly disturbing. I was told that my current partner was not the right person for me and that I should consider leaving her as I would meet someone better. In fact, Stuart, and Janet later also, constantly tried to convince me that I should break off and cut my relationships to my family, my girlfriend, and friends. Throughout my experience with expansions at the time, I was constantly doubting myself and my relationships to the people close to me. In particular, however, I was informed that I was specifically programmed and part of satanic sex rituals of the Illuminati. My own subsequent research into this matter, a subject which in turn is documented rather too well, left me with a very horrible impression and sensation of these rituals. I was traumatized by this information for months. Finally, and especially towards the end, the consultations, for which I paid, turned out to be counseling for Stuart for a number of personal issues. Not sure how I ended up there, but nonetheless, I ended up paying for counseling, consulting someone else. Indeed, very stupid for me to do so. So Swerdlow apparently went on to tell Jacaranda that they were very special and they were a chosen one by the Kuiper's Belt aliens, and that they and other special agents were supposed to save the world. More quotes. Of course, if you disagreed with any of what Stuart told you, the Kuiper's Belt aliens would simply switch you off. That is, you would no longer be a Kuiper's Belt alien agent and thus lose your unique chance to save this planet. At the same time, I was told by Stuart that we had shared several lifetimes together and that this was our sacred mission. As time went on, Stuart suggested and told me that it would be good to deprogram me using what he calls Willem Reich techniques. These are outlined in detail in his book, The True Reality of Sexuality. In a nutshell, what happens is that the deprogrammer, in this case Stuart, masturbates you to the point of just before orgasm and keeps his client there for as long as possible while the mind deprograms, and after orgasm, the deprogramming session ends. I have since learned that this is not an isolated case at all, and that there are a number of people who have reported this sexual stalking and harassment to the point of actual sexual assault. I can, of course, only speak for myself, but I was told by Stuart Swerdlow that he had sexually deprogrammed other people. Wow, I had no idea this was going to get so... Gross. Gross. Might have to put a trigger warning on this. In spring 2011, Jacaranda visited the Swerdlows at their home in Michigan and became aware of the many conflicts and small wars that the Swerdlows were engaged in, their opponents often people that they were once very close with or business partners. The Swerdlows always explained that these people had their programming triggered and didn't know what they were doing. Jacaranda would later find most of these attacks were initiated by Swerdlows themselves. After leaving, Jacaranda would learn that they'd been put on a death list by the Swerdlows, along with 12 to 15 other former clients, friends, or business associates. The question one would have to ask is this: if their message and work was so neutral and charitable, why are there so many disgruntled former clients, why is it necessary to put them on a hit list? Some of the more outrageous claims from their website include the following. Only drink distilled water. Psychiatry is a form of mind control. That's very Scientology, by the way. The U.S. government has created the HIV virus to eliminate the African populations in order to stop planet Nibiru from invading. Hey, you guys, isn't that also very Scientology? The planet Nibiru was, however, destroyed in 2010. Okay. They also claim that Amy Winehouse died as part of a satanic ritual sacrifice. And I guess there's more. I don't even think I want to go to that website. Should we? Maybe we should. And there was another user who says his workshops, especially the Insiders Group, are specifically and extra programmed to help destroy the Illuminati. In order to be able to join that group, the expansions member has to cough up $10,000 and is told that they are very important to help fight the dark powers and the takeover of the planet by alien forces and entities. This sounds like a bigger scam than Scientology, and somebody's going to find this podcast because we know how they are whenever you mention them. So this person got deeper and they found an event listing for 2005 for expansions. And there were a bunch of questions that would be answered in the talk. And here's the list. How does sexuality replicate the original creative force of the God mind? Is there a global plan to control humanity through sexuality? What does masturbation have to do with God mind? Why should you wait for the correct sexual relationship? What do the sexual trinity of love, intimacy, and trust and the sexual trinity of mind control have in common? How can hyperspace techniques help to conceive the best child for you? How can people be sexually deprogrammed? Why are sexual relationships difficult for specifically programmed people? How do your sexual fantasies describe your personal relationship to the God mind? What role does group sexuality have in bringing forth physical manifestations? My God. Wow. So we can even bring up a teeny bit about QAnon, because QAnon basically absorbs all conspiracy theories. So the author of this was talking to someone they know, and it got them to thinking about QAnon. So they say that they did a little Google search and they found an interview by Laura Eisenhower that was with Stuart Swerdlow from 2018 to bring this up a little more current. And here is what Stuart had to say. The Q movement, as I have subsequently found in this past year or so, is legitimate. Q is not a person, it's a group. It's less than 10 people. Yeah, right, dude. Approximately 9, 6 of whom are deep military intelligence. The other 3 are alien extraterrestrial, and they have been monitoring for a very long time. They are connected, the extraterrestrial part, to what I have been talking about for the last 12, 13 years as being part of the Kuiper Belt group, which I know we will discuss in a moment, and they have an agenda to remove the deep state from this planet. Oh God, the cray is deep. The cray is deep. So there's a little sections here that they have on inconsistencies and things that you might consider. Like when you and your friends tell the same story for 30 years, things might change with time. But it's easily dismissed when you can say that you're still recovering your memories and that you're probably still partially programmed, right? So it's very convenient to say that. There's a YouTube video entitled Montauk Survivors. The video is over 3 hours long, and it consists of Bielek, Nichols, and Duncan telling their story, if you want to look that up. But even in the video, they cannot keep their story straight. In the first hour, Nichols says a couple of people were lost in time. In the second hour, he says no one was lost in time. But in his book, he suggests hundreds of people were lost. Now, some believe the group is part of a government disinformation campaign team whose job it is to spread distortions, half-truths, and falsehoods about the true nature and purpose of government mind control projects. And I just want to remind you, if you haven't been listening to me for long, that I have done episodes about psychokinesis and poltergeists and things like that, and automatic writing, which do sometimes touch upon the government, because they did do legitimate experiments, like on remote viewing. This is psychic phenomenon. And remote viewing in particular, there was a whole thing I remember talking about. So it's not impossible. Like, or what I'm saying is, not everything is some crazy conspiracy theory. The government has done research into things that other people think is bullshit, basically, okay? Plenty of people think that anything psychic phenomena is bullshit. The government has done it, though. Whether or not it's anything this crazy, that's another story. But I'm just letting you know that maybe part of the reason these things can take off is it could start out with some kernel of truth, you know, and then they just run with it. And people are like, how can anybody believe in this culty stuff? It's not as difficult as you think if you start out small. Plenty of intelligent people can kind of get into the small things, and then it just snowballs into something big. It can happen. So there is also a documentary by Christopher Garantano called Dark Files Garantano, and he takes two other hosts to Nicholas's quote unquote lab, where some random guy is wandering around wearing a pot on his head. And one of the hosts says something along the lines of, if you wanted to make sure no one believed this stuff, you couldn't hire better people. Now, there's been, you know, Alfred Bielek's rendition of the Philadelphia experiment. It's been heard several times in conferences, lectures, and videos. His story is essentially the same, I guess. Although one person who attended 2 days of a lecture says that Bielek, after having had a contradiction in his story pointed out, incorporated the updated material in the lecture the next day in such a way as to imply that there was never a contradiction. So it sounds like he's a really good storyteller, and he has a respectable demeanor and sincere, I guess, so you just want to believe him, and then he will plagiarize any information that comes his way. Then there's this quote from Chris Ketchum from Gear Magazine, November 2001. Nichols says the Montauk narrative goes completely haywire, packed with so many subplots and subprojects that you need a tree chart to track the twists and the players. Log on to one of 10,000 Montauk-related websites worldwide, and you'll learn that the Montauk cabal had a hand in the creation of AIDS, the murder of JFK, the death of the dinosaurs, and quite possibly your negative credit rating as well. The Montaukians could find a conspiracy in a pizza crust. So by the time the 6-volume Montauk series comes to its breathless close, it's no surprise the Camp Hero operatives are at long last outed as part of that mega cabal, the New World Order elite, who are now, we learn, manipulating history through time travel. I called up Dick White, 61, of the ancient clan of Montauk Whites, who has lived near the base his whole life. Quote from Montauk. A quote from Dick White. Peter Moon called me and asked me about things that I'd seen growing up here, White told me, and then twisted my words to fit into his cockamamie story. The fan fiction. So usually when we see a conspiracy theory, the primary narrative is presented by one person. But in this case, you have at least five people to contributing to the core. That's Nichols, Bielek, Cameron, Swerdlow, and Peter Moon. Nichols and Bielek are the most prolific, of course, and they've lived across the country from each other. In 1991 is when Bielek added the Philadelphia experiment. To recap, did they plan it? We don't know. Or did they just choose it? We don't know. Because about the same can be said about the claim that Duncan is his brother. So, now, this really comes full circle, because the author of this article says, anyone who has ever played Dungeons & Dragons knows how discomforting it is for other people to make choices for you. And we're going to go just a little bit farther here with a well-known Barry Goldwater. So shortly after a USPA talk in 1986, Nichols claims they got a U.S. senator involved in a private investigation into Camp Hero, and that was one Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater, of course, is a real person and a senator from Arizona from 1953 to 1987. He had a four-year break in the 60s. He was a harsh critic of Republicans, which is funny and fun because he is one, was one. He was possibly a cool dude, though, back when Republicans could be cool, because he advocated for the right for homosexuals to serve openly in the military. He was for environmental protection, abortion rights, and the legalization of medical marijuana. So why Goldwater? In 1975, Goldwater admitted to having an interest in UFOs. So in 1994, he made a famous statement on Larry King. Quote, "I think the government does know. I can't back that up, but I think that at Wright-Patterson Field, if you could get into certain places, you'd find out what the Air Force and the government knows about UFOs. I called Curtis LeMay and I said, 'General, I know we have a room at Wright-Patterson where you put all this secret stuff. Could I go in there?' I've never heard him get mad, but he got madder than hell at me, cussed me out, and said, 'Don't ever ask me that question again.'" End quote. So in the first edition of the book, the Montauk one, which was published in 92, the senator wasn't actually named. It didn't appear until a reprint in 2017, which is 20 years after Goldwater's death, which makes me, doesn't that make you suspicious? Like, oh, we're going to wait until he's dead so he can't dispute anything, maybe? And they say here they've been unable to find evidence that Goldwater had anything at all to do with Montauk. Their story, they claim that he took it on as a private investigation, but there's no evidence of him even being in Montauk. And then there's someone named Joe Lefreno. He grew up in Montauk, works for park services, doing maintenance around Camp Hero State Park. He believes he's a Montauk boy. He claims that in 1981, when he was 12 or 13, that's when he was first abducted. It was under hypnosis that a local boy that no one knew very well invited him to bike to the base. Quote, "I didn't believe it until 1994. I was hypnotized by a certified hypnotist for about 40 minutes, and all these memories flooded back. They did a very bad thing to us out there. We were just little kids. They had no right to experiment on us. It was a very dark, very evil thing." Chris Garantano had a chance to interview Joe for his show Strange World, and they were doing this on Discovery. They met up at Camp Hero Park to chat, and before they could get started, Joe's boss apparently showed up and told him he wasn't allowed to give an interview. Garantano did get to speak with Joe later, but Joe was hesitant about saying too much at risk of his job. And then we come to someone named Marshall Barnes, Bielek debunked. Over the years, a myriad of people have tried to debunk these claims. One guy in particular, Marshall Barnes, had the biggest, fattest hate on for Bielek you could imagine. So much so that he made a now defunct website, Bielek Debunked, and spent a decade trying to counter Bielek's story. So one paragraph, quote from Barnes, they have here is, "The Incunabula is probably the most important underground research document that I've ever come across. Incunabula info preceded the release of the MP stuff and what was gave the MP stuff credibility for me. The Incunabula is the key to the whole ball of wax and is what those of us who are on the good side of the secret faith keep our focus on." You're like, what the hell is that? Well, so am I. Here, I'm going to tell you. The Incunabula papers is all the evidence behind Ong's hat, which is a story someone uncovered, someone named Nathan here, they say, covered a long time ago. Now, this is a very interesting website because they have this all, they have all of these on their website, okay? I will put this website in the show notes, thehumanexception.com. Very deep, very deep. So they are, the Incunabula papers are purely collaborative fiction. It's as if the authors of the Montauk Project came out and said it was all a joke. And this guy thinks they're the most important underground research documents he had ever seen. So the issue wasn't necessarily with the theories that Barnes had, but with the people. Quote from Marshall Barnes, skeptics are inherently stupid, and their stupidity is based in fear. So Barnes makes some good connections and observations. It's got to be taken with a grain of salt. They go on here. This is so deep. There's someone named Andy Pero, a.k.a. Mr. X, a.k.a. Mr. Coffee. August 1998, they tell someone here, Eve Lorgren, tells of Nichols coming to speak about Montauk and about a Montauk boy, Andy Pero. Quote, as my memory comes back, I discover that I was not only used as an assassin, but that I actually was one of the Montauk boys as well. All the events Nichols describes in his book are 100% true. However, the fact that the project was supposedly abandoned at Camp Hero in the year 83 could not be farther from the truth, as I was also there sometime between the years 88 and 1993, and the project is still going. So after the event, Nichols, Lorgren, and this guy Andy go to a cafe and they keep talking. And Andy tells them that in 1998, he was arrested in his home in New Jersey by local police on behalf of the FBI, aided by a complaint from his vengeful ex-girlfriend. And he was then thrown into a mental institute, but was able to get out a couple weeks later. Do the police arrest people on the behalf of the FBI? That I don't think so. I thought the FBI arrested their own people. So, quote, I was told recently by Preston Nichols that not long after the spring of 99, Andy traveled to Arizona and got involved in some cult, perhaps to stay hidden and out of the system. Maybe he got reprogrammed by cult members. He then traveled out of country to Korea and to such exotic places as Nepal, Tibet, and Kathmandu. By mid-year 2000, Andy returned to the States out of money. He went back to New Jersey to ask for money from his family, which resulted in another unfortunate incident. His family refused to give him money, so he took what was needed, aka he stole it, and a car and cash by force. Yeah, he stole it. And that's the last that was heard of Andy. And he did list a full name and birth date. So they did Google them. They did research it. And in 2000, Andy was taken to court in New Jersey for an alleged kidnapping and assault. The victim was Eleanor Pero, his mother. Eleanor was having breakfast when Andy appeared to snap. He grabbed her and threw her from the table. He proceeded to physically assault her and threaten her with a knife, and this attack lasted 20 minutes. The defendant was making delusional remarks, saying that he did not come back to live in the house with video bugs so that they could watch him. Eleanor also explained that her son believed that the FBI wanted to clone him for his DNA because he had superpowers. So he forced her then to drive to the bank to take out all that money, shortly after which she escaped to a nearby post office and called 911. He was charged with third-degree criminal restraint and was imprisoned for some time. This is not the end of his story. To bring it more up to date, April 8, 2020, Andy was apprehended by Richardson, Texas police for the murder of an old college friend. The case status at this time is still pending. For the most part, the Montauk community seems unaware of Andy's activities post this story, or if they do know, they ignore it. We could go on. This is so deep, you guys. At this point, I don't know how long I've been talking. I think I need to stop because, wow, this goes on and on with several different people. I think they're talking about a lot of Montauk boys, but it makes me think, maybe I should do an episode on this Andy guy, what he did to his poor mother. Let me know if you would be into that. That would veer into a true crime connected to conspiracy. That's wow. Andy Pero. Yeah, if you want to hear that, let me know. Hit me up on Twitter at PodPinky. I got to stop. I'm surprised I didn't get completely tongue twisted. Oh, holy crap. I've been talking for almost 2 hours. Yeah, we got to stop. And I hope you stuck with me because it probably seemed very confusing and a little bland at the beginning. But man, once we got into the quotes and some of the people, it got really crazy. And I can't believe how much this is connected to. I had no idea when I started it. So this was quite the episode of I had an idea. I looked it up a bit ahead of time, just a bit. And it also ended up being sort of a Google roulette, I think you would say, because I got all of that mostly from that website. I'm going to end here because you're probably exhausted. Maybe I should call this a season 4 comeback or a season 3 finale. Whew! Before I completely sign off, I do want to let you know a couple of things. I verified the story about the guy who works at the park and recreation there. I also verified that there are people talking about Stuart Swerdlow on a website called culteducation.com. And there are other people besides the one that was mentioned in this episode who have the same allegations. And then there was the filmmaker Christopher Garantano. Now, he made that documentary, Montauk Chronicles. I mentioned him in this. He does not think that Nichols, Bielek, and Swerdlow are credible. However, he does say that he employed a geophysicist to analyze the ground beneath the old base. And he says that they found evidence of large structures not seen on any official maps, which I don't think would be strange. And the parks guy, they apparently also found some evidence of some covered up house that he had talked about. But what the documentary guy says is, you know, forget about the alien stuff and MK Ultra, which I mentioned at the top. He does think it's possible there was some type of experimentation using kids or teenagers who were maybe runaways. And locals who even say that this, you know, conspiracy theory is BS, they do say that when the tower, the radar tower, when it was up and running, they said that it did kind of mess with television sets and electronics, and that some people reported suffering from headaches. I'm not going to read any more out of that article, but excuse me, that goes with what I told you about electromagnetic energy. So that doesn't mean that there's a conspiracy, but that could be very true. I totally believe that. And maybe it just fed into everything else that was going on. So just wanted to give those couple of little updates that I found afterwards. Thank you for listening to this maxi episode, if you made it all this way. Find me at Twitter at PodPinky, Instagram, Pinky_podcast. Go to my website, pinkyswearpress.com, and please check out my new novel, Dark Wings, Urban Fantasy, Male-Male Romance, if you're into that sort of thing. And I have other books. And that is that. Poo-poo, poo-pow, and don't stand too close to any radar towers.